Thanks very much for the introduction. I hope I'm not breaking too many taboos. I just want to read a couple of vulnerable words from the novel. It's very, very short, so don't worry too much about it. It is set in the legal world in Paris, which is a very strange world from our perspective. It's different. They don't have, but basically, they don't have the idea of being innocent when you're proven guilty. It's quite the reverse. So when they make you, you have to prove that you're innocent. They don't have habeas corpus, any of that sort of thing. And this is what the novel is about, a young Irishman who gets himself into trouble over there in a very serious way, and it's about the efforts of a young, indeed not so young, advocate, a lawyer, who has not yet got his own business, his own cabinet, as we call it, but he works for a firm of lawyers, and he works on dreadful sort of penny pinching little cases. And he's also hampered in his own life by the fact that he's rural, he's not from Paris. And anyone who knows Paris will know there's a huge snobbism, as they call it, in Paris about people who are not Parisian. And he, when he was in university, he invented a little organisation for himself and others called Les Flaubertois, after Flaubert's notions of rural bourgeoisie, to sort of protect himself from the Parisians around. Anyway, that's very much a side topic of the whole story. In this very staid, trying to be very, very ordinary appearing avocat, this lawyer, goes to meet his long-term partner, Marcel, who happens to be a waiter in a restaurant. But the restaurant has changed in Paris, and the old official professional waiters have disappeared, more or less. He has just been to the jail to interview his client, the young Irishman, so he has a tape recorder, a mini cassette, with him. Of the interview, and he goes to the restaurant to have lunch, and this is very quickly what happens. There's mention of an area in it called La Cité. La Cité is the kind of general term. It doesn't mean city. It means those outlying areas where you don't go, basically. We saw some of this on television a few years ago. The police don't even go there. They get fired upon when they go to Paris, or the huge one. Marseille has another one, La Cité. If you come from La Cité, you've got a hell of a lot of social maneuvering to do to be anybody, basically. Marcel was thin, tall, his head and face shaven. He had nut-brown eyes, and his skin, too, was delicately browned. His Semitic nose gave away his half-Algerian parentage. With great deftness, he balanced a round tin tray in one hand. And on the tray sat two plates of assorted salad and a woven yellow basket of bread. The avocat's breathing slowed down, but he couldn't ignore the tightness in his throat. Marcel was beautiful. He was a lucky man. Marcel, not unbalancing the tray by one degree, leaned over and kissed him on the cheek. The tables were crowded. There was nowhere to sit. Marcel bounced off, came back, the tray dragging down by his side. I bought you decent shoes, and you wear these. Marcel pulled a clown's face. An angel trying to look like a devil. For here, they are comfortable. I would destroy good shoes. I love you for your decent shoes. Stop. Find me a place. Anything for you. Stop. I'm hungry. Someone shouted something at Marcel from the dimmer distances of the restaurant's interior. Marcel cocked his ass. The avocat didn't really like it when it got all so... What was the word? A couple of business women got up from a small round table, an explosion like ducks from cover of colours and flapping and hurried noises. Marcel rushed upon them, hands to the bill, the money, the tip, hoisted their used plates and cutlery onto his tray, made a showy rushing down of a chair. For Maître l'avocat, are you joining me? I will. 5 minutes, maybe two, that's all. How was your day? Marcel seated himself on the edge of a chair across the table. Traffic on the Rue de Rivoli honked and banged and blared, and on their little square someone started up a big Japanese motorbike. You couldn't hear anything else but the background noise. Then it was gone. A blue petrol smoke in the air, and they looked at each other. My day was the prison again. Marcel's cool fingers were on his wrist now. His snow-white shirt cuffed a few centimetres from those manicured nails. Marcel was the most fastidious man he's ever met. He changed his socks twice a day, maybe three times, but now and then his dress sent a childish defiance. My poor boy. I hate that place. Every time I have to go there, I feel I leave something of myself behind. Marcel said nothing. A good listener. I shouldn't bring this to you. Who else should you bring it to? I love you. For a moment, he could only smile. Marcel made everything simple, stripped away the complication, said, this is how things are. As a teenager, he'd had petrol poured over him up in the towers of last day because the others found out he was queer and only emergency surgery had saved him from being a eunuch. As it was, the scars, red, thick, mapped out the bottom of his belly and thighs as if mapping the Atlas Mountains. What will you eat? He eyed the menu. Perhaps he didn't really want to talk. Omelette, this one, frites, I suppose, no salad, glass of white. Marcel scribbled quickly. He could work in a court. He should be a reporter. I've news too, said Marcel. Not much, but to me, a lot. Two poems in La Muette. What do you mean, not much? I think that's terrific. When? September, perhaps. You know how they are. Takes so long, the feeling of accomplishment vanishes by the time you get the magazine. I've seen a copy of La Muette on someone's desk in my office. It's widely read. Marcel moves back a step. You're a liar, but that's okay. A liar in a good cause. He couldn't help but laugh. Marcel kissed him again on the cheek and walked away. A man's walk this time. Muscular, nothing mincing there. He'd played football once. Some said he'd been not at all bad. Now he wrote and worked at the restaurant. Or worked at the restaurant and wrote. 3 years is a long time, the avocat felt happily. Life has been good to us. Once inside the restaurant, Marcel shouted and bantered with the rest. My father thought the avocat would have walked straight out of any restaurant that didn't have professional aproned waiters. He opened his briefcase, looking for his novel. But the first thing that fell out was his mini cassette recorder. As it struck the ground, it started up. And for a few seconds, until he claimed it again and shut it off, it emitted the voice of his Irish client. From under the table, the voice sounded like an insect scraping against a piece of tin. And off they go. This is a little collection of poems called True North, which came out a few years ago now, I think, at this stage. And I was trying a few little different things in it. I was trying different attempts at style and form, and I was very attracted by the old Irish Gaelic metre. And the fact that having a foot in the traditional music camp, I knew that a lot of songs which are written nowadays in English by people like Tim Dennehy and Tim Lyons, for example, are actually constructed in English, but with internal Gaelic metre. It's quite unconscious, but you can actually hear them. You hear it banging along, you hear it beating along, supporting it. So that metre is still alive, it hasn't vanished, it hasn't disappeared with the sort of Merriman notion of the ghost of poetry. And this is a poem from, simply called From the Irish, Perhaps. No peace now that love has gone. No place of comfort, no going home. Singing I miss on your own tune, your laughing voice in a loud room, your bright eye across the full table, your fingers on my arm in passing. My empty bed is lit by your red moon, no sleep for me on the softest down. Day I dread for its useful duty, night for its wide hours of self-pity. You were my hour of sun in winter, the full wine glass, the brimming pitcher. Your going put the dark in me, killed the light I guarded jealously. Nothing is new now, everything is old. The summer is windy and wet and cold. Another little poem, very similar in style again, and experimenting with that notion of the day of misery. This is a poem which is named after a traditional tune, which some of you may know, My Love is Sleep. Anybody know it? You know that tune? No? Fiddle players know that? My Love is Sleep. All the vast day's riot falters here. The lake of her silence is deep, motionless, and clear. Unlike my own small well of wide-eyed spite, perturbed, unfathomable, black of a winter's night. I'll finish with this little book. There's a lot of talk nowadays about, I've noticed in the papers, it's in the Tubridy show. maybe Tubridy wouldn't be brave enough to tackle this, I don't know, probably not. About drink and how much people are drinking, young people are drinking and all this kind of thing. The traditional music scene is rife with it, but not as much as it was when I was a younger lad, when it was the expected thing that musicians were off their face. That was the thing to do. It was quasi-romantic. There wasn't a bar in Galway at the time, because nobody got paid. That was another thing. Money ruined the trad scene, but that's a whole other nice argument. Nobody got paid. You got soggy sandwiches made on the actual bar. So you got half a pint of Bass in your sandwich. And that was it, a couple of pints. And the alcoholism rate was through the roof. It was very common, I remember batches of us doing this, actually sleeping in the pub where we were playing that night and getting up the following day and off you go. But this was accepted and the tourists loved it. They thought it was very Irish. But one by one people began to seriously deny, which happened. And I was counting the other day that five out of a dozen people I knew then are dead now. And they're all younger than me. And they all died of the one thing, basically. One of them indeed was from Cork. One chap I was unfortunate to actually see die, watch him die. That was a pretty horrific and very unromantic sight. And I think after that, for a lot of people in Galway, that kind of killed off the idea of, isn't it going to be a musician and piss? He was strapped to a cot-like device in a hospital, and he had eaten part of his wrist because he was trying to numb the pain in some way or other. So he started eating his wrist. So they had to tape up his wrist to prevent him doing that. And I always remember the smell in the room, which was an iron blood smell, because they were putting it into it, putting blood into him and taking it out. He'd gotten rid of his liver by effectively pissing it out. So that was the end of that. And he lasted a few hours in appalling pain. And this was a man who stood up in the pub with a fiddle by his hand one day and told us that he would die drunk. But unfortunately for him, he didn't. He died sober. Needless to say, just by way of adding to the hypocrisy of the whole thing, people who wouldn't say hello to him in the street when he was alive filled the pub on the night of his death to say what a great lad he's been. Well, it happens all over the world, but I mean, it just happens here more pronouncedly than anywhere else. And he now has the very dubious honour of, there's a pub in Galway, with a portrait of him on the wall. There you go. There's fame. Of course, his pacing from the bed to the window. You're right, I know all that. And out of focus gazing at the rampant grass, a smell like ether poised at the edge of things. He longed for a cigarette, it was forbidden. A half-drunk bottle of Lucozade, something lying in ambush behind the plastic curtain. This gut ache, he said, that will not go away. Later, a hell scene in a private room. Strapped into a cot with metal sides, hair gone, the steady beat of a suction pump, eyes blindly mad overnight, arms mummied up in bandages, he was eating away the pain, going out too slowly. Room full of pretty nurses, the kind he cracked jokes at, iron in the clammy hot air, shrinking visibly. For a week, hard men in pubs drank to his memory, who stepped over him often in the street. He was a wild man. He was so true, a queer tongue on. Isn't the drink the curse? Just one more from this. I meant to do this one earlier on. It's again one of the gay poems. It's called Wood. O young love, be good, be full of longing as a windy wood. Be full of anger as one poet envying what another has. Be at your best when your poet sickens and neglects his pen. And if your love dies, go quietly, leave him where he lies. But for now, love, be good, full of whispers as a windy wood. Very much. This is the little book that you were referring so kindly to, the Oracle Room. I was saying recently that I'm very bad. I know that people can do it when they're asked for collections. Some people can go away and they sort everything out meticulously and categorically when it was written, and you know, according to deaths, marriages, and births, and all that sort of thing. I can't really do that, and I tend to, because I'm lazy, grab poems that haven't been published and put them in any kind of order in 20 books. Sometimes it works, but sometimes it doesn't. This is a poem that somebody mentioned recently before a reading, so I thought I would probably have a go at it. It's a simple ballad form style. There's nothing ingenious about it or anything else. But it struck me that there are so many poetry festivals. They're everywhere. You know, they're like sort of like crustaceans, right?
Mushrooms.
Well, mushrooms. Don't knock the humble mush. But they are. They're everywhere. They are the mushrooms. Yeah. And you wonder about them sometimes. You know, you wonder, are we reading to ourselves? A little touch of incest here. Yeah. Keep it in the family. You sometimes do wonder, I mean, who are the audiences? Where are they? What am I actually saying? That was greatly inviting. I do sometimes wonder about. And it struck me one time that if we do have these sort of little poetic love-ins, or literary love-ins, or musical love-ins, do we have any effect at all on the outside world? Do we actually reach conclusion at the end of that? It struck me, of course, that we don't. We don't. And anybody who's ever been at any of the more raucous literary festivals will probably recognise some of the events in this. Anyway, it's a little polite satire, or impolite polite satire. Lines written after a poetry festival. Now that the poetry's over, there's Gaza and Iraq, and the crooked politicians doing deals behind our backs. The addicts are still with us. single mothers, barely 12. There's speculators, bagmen, buying councillors, resolve. The Yanks still dump their soldiers in our airports and hotels. No port worth a travel grant, there sound the warning bell. For now the poetry's over, and real life shuts us down. The old can die on trolleys, as before, without sound. The homeless lie in doorways, the bent and greedy rule. The some should be in prison, but a poet's no one's fool. The festival is over, we're up for sale again. I'll clam up if the price is right, you won't hear me complain. Bomb them back to the Stone Age, it's all the same to us. The wretched don't read poetry, so what's the bloody fuss? So what about Geneva, conventions and all that? As a poet I'm unconventional, so I can wear any hat. My middle name is silent now that the boozing's done, the screwing and the backslapping, the harmless poetical fun. Would things were different. Sad to see in any country pub nowadays the old man being led out at the end of the night by his son, which is a common sight. An old man who undoubtedly when he was young had all the bravery and aspiration and courage and belief that his son now does. But you do see this, and this is based on a particular case that I saw, of a man struggling, fighting his way against his own approaching age while his son held him out the door. It's called The Woman. He's taken for a novelty now, but he wasn't always. Back in the bad days, he ran the place. His word was our law, and no harm either. The soft welter of him now. You'd think he'd never been a clever man, but he was. He can't sing now, but he could back then. Only the young can mock like that, urging him on and his voice gone. He's a fool to himself, feeling the young girl's slim backs and thinking what was naughty 40 years ago is naughty now. I am his son. I am the one who waits while he pisses himself. I am the one who carries this old Christ up the hill to his bed of skulls. I am the one who rolls the stone over his grave. This is a little poem which involves me doing a double take, two voices, in the middle of the poem. Like a lot of people, particularly single or only children, as I am one, I have spent my life talking to myself. Indeed, I may be doing that right now. But it's interesting as a practice. You know those things you get in programs sometimes, Derek, say Ryan Tuberty. Today's mystery voice. Right? And you get a tenner. Of course, you can never figure out who it is. And then it's 20 quid tomorrow. 25, 20, no. Eventually it's day one. I was wondering if you were listening. This is okay. This idea about radio and communication is okay. It's all very well in our part of the hemisphere, but there are parts of the world where radio and communications and media are taboo and are controlled. So supposing you were listening to the radio one day and on came today's mystery voice, and suddenly you recognized it as being the monster from your childhood, the monster from your young manhood, the monster from somewhere else in your past.
What's this rubbish
perspective?
Pardon? What's this rubbish
perspective?
This what?
Gistro.
Yeah, well, that's perspective.
What is gistro?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just
a right, yes. Yeah, you're ahead of me, actually. Jumping over me and leaps and bounds. Supposing you recognize this voice, and were filled not with the sort of housewifely devil-may-care attitude I think will ring up and recognize it for a tenor, but with sheer terror, what would happen? So here we go. Here is today's mystery voice. I rang, said I knew the voice, knew when I'd heard it last, the circumstances, the dark room. We have to move on, caller. I asked, how can a man like that be on your program? How can... I'm sorry, caller. You don't know who he is, obviously. You don't understand what he's capable. I'm sorry, caller, I must insist with you, I don't understand. I said, you say he's a famous... Please don't say anything offensive, caller. I must remind you, you're on air. You mean on the air. What I'm saying is, that mystery voice of yours is no mystery, at least not to me, and I don't want your money. Caller, I must be rude and hang up if you've nothing more to contribute. I almost died when I heard that voice. Now he's famous as a what, you say? Does no one remember that? That's it, caller. There are other people on the line, perhaps some other radio show. Ask him about the stairs and the room. It's a recording, caller. For Christ's sake, just ask him. The windows. Thank you, caller, and goodbye. Someone must remember. Remember, like me. I can't believe that no one else... No correct answer today, listener, so the prize goes up and we play our mystery voice tomorrow morning again. Maybe, for all we know, any day now, for a tenner, they will come back. This poem was written after a real event, which took, it's called X-Files because it does sound very, very strange. It deserves a little bit of explanation, very briefly. I was in Bewley's restaurant in Grafton Street in Dublin, having been up in Belfast previously, and I was knackered, and I went into Bewley's in the good old days when you could still get the all-day breakfast at 1 o'clock in the morning. And there was this chap joined me, from out of nowhere, he just slid in behind me. And he was completely and utterly nondescript. He was a small man in a Burberry raincoat, kind of briefcase, and balding, and very uninteresting looking. And we started talking, as people do when they're tired and bored, about the price of breakfast. And I thought it was very dear, really. I mean, oh yeah, he said. It was a very soft, lilting American accent. He said, it's not that expensive up in Belfast. I said, no, actually, it isn't. I've just been up there this morning and blah, 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 and so on. And we're moving along, filling our plates up with just buttered, whatever, and marmalade and all the rest. And I said, what do you do for a living? He says, well, I fix small countries. And I said, well, how do you mean fix? Oh, do you think yours needs fixing? This got very weird. And it was weird because it was just said like that. It was like, you know, I work for CIE. He said, well, actually, no, to be honest. He said, I work for an aircraft company. I said, who are they? He said, you wouldn't know them. They're a commercial bunch called Southern Air Transport. So that was it, and off he went. And I went back to school, and there was a friend of mine who used to work in the diplomat, the Irish diplomat, before, and I rang him. And I explained it, and I explained what I thought had happened. And he laughed at the end of the phone, and he said, oh, yeah, well, Southern Air Transport is the CIA. They are a legitimate company, I mean, you can send things through them, but they are a cover for the CIA. And they fly in the Shannon. So I said, was this guy real? Oh, yeah, absolutely. But now, there's no hiding it. There's no James Bond-esque thing going on. There's a guy who will come up in a restaurant and say, how you doing? I'm from the CIA. So they're there. And if our government ever says they're not in this country, they're lying. They are here, and they operate, and they're in Bewley's. There's a big four. And this microphone is tampered with, I know. Okay, it's fine. If you're touching, you are also being touched. That's a little quote from Aidan Guffey, the Colony Room. In a Dublin restaurant, self-service, hot light, a bald man, like any other, said he fixed small countries. He said this like he would say, I work in a garage. That was what he did. In his grey raincoat, he looked like a businessman caught between flights. His accent polite, Midwest, campus American. He was hungry, we both were. comparing the prices of cafe breakfasts here and in Belfast, started it. He knew that city. He mentioned a good hotel. Balancing a full tray while holding a briefcase isn't easy. Do you think we need fixing? I said.
You'd know better than me, she answered,
knifing up the two squares from four. They're out there. Believe me, they really are.
They're in here.
Oh, yeah.
They're in here.
I believe it.
I'm one. This is the story which I will not say whether this is true or not, in case somebody slams a writ on me or something. This happened in a town I know so well, and I've titled the poem Sex Ring Vanishes Shock. I told you, there, see? There you are. Satellite has me pinned here. As every national newspaper printed the trades, professions, occupations of the dozen members of the town's rent-boy sex ring, police investigating the case announced that there would be no prosecutions and the matter was, basically, closed. A bloke who ran his own community news sheet made newsy inquiries, was visited late at night by members of a special police unit we had hitherto believed investigated only crimes against the state. This is a true story. It's up to you whether you believe it. The town is no different from yours. It has trapdoors and fail-safe mechanisms, and holes where nosy people trip and fall. You do what you must. That's an absolutely true story, believe it or not. There will be no further prosecution. And indeed there were none. You can get away with crime in this situation. I'll finish up from this book with a little poem called Thoughts for Lent. It's based on a Breton form of lament, very similar to what we've had in Gaelic. But they were still writing these and putting music to them well into the end of the 19th century. And they're called Gwerth. They're beautiful, beautiful things in the book too. Especially in the book music. And this comes from the words Malor Barth Hos Odverveld. After 100 years there is neither seeing nor hearing, and so I curse my aging. Having spoken for 100 winters, my tongue is frozen, so I curse the winter. Having laughed for 100 winters, my tears are frozen, so I curse sorrow. Having had speed in my sinews and strength, I am myself frozen. I curse all things that move. Having wept at the dying of friends, I have no friends left. I curse my friends. Having touched beautiful women, my fingers are numb. I curse beauty. Having had so long a life, I am caged up in my own bones, and so I curse life. I'd like to finish up with thank you very much for asking me here and for being such a great listener. It always helps when people are listening. I've started of late, a couple of years ago basically, I started translating French stories and poems into English. And I enjoyed it. It was great fun. And it was great to go back to that child sense again, where you had to relearn language. And language had to... It is seldom told us. And I found that this was not only great fun, it was a great lesson to me. It was what it was like to be a child again. Every word had to mean something. What did that word mean? Well, it also meant this. And it meant that. The whole act of translation is getting to know other people, basically. That's one of the things that certainly is for me. It's putting on a new pair of eyes, seeing the world in a different way. It's not simply word for word, he said, she said. There's other things involved in it. So I thought, having done this and having published a few translations of short stories, I thought I might start writing in French. and see what happens. For a lot of reasons, which are quite sort of obscure to anybody else, but to me, I've gone through a whole period of being very fed up with writing poetry at all here, but that's just purely a personal thing. And then I thought, well, if you're writing in another language, you can publish them somewhere else as well. So that actually slowly began to happen, that the poems did get published in France, gradually. Not all of them, and not at once, but very, very gradually they did. And what I discovered, and I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, the old thrill is back after all those years. You remember, you know when you send in a poem to somebody, your first poem, and they send back the letter saying, we're full up for the next 10 issues, you know, and that sort of thing. And then you get the one saying, well, you sent us 4 poems, we'd like that one. And the first time that happens, the kick of it is terrific. Very addictive. Maybe that's one of the things that keeps you going. Well, I'd lost all of that. I'd lost it completely. I remember all of us coming in saying, we'd take this poem and that poem, and I would say, oh great, drop the fire. I just wasn't interested. It was gone. And I found that I was churning out poems one after the other because it was raining and I couldn't go out. Or because CSI Miami was Mark, or CSI Las Vegas was Marge Heldenberger wasn't on. And I was just, you know, boredom. And I was writing because I was bored and I thought this is a disease. So, but writing in another language changed all of that. At least I think something. I read 2 poems, just 2. And one is quite short. And I read them in French and then I read the translation. This is to a friend of mine who died last year, who was a great traditional musician, who played with us in the group for a long time, called Parsons Hash. He played here in Cork, indeed. In the lobby, would it be right? We were in the lobby. We decorated the lobby. And at one stage, and he died, unfortunately, of cancer last year. Great musician. He was blind from almost birth. And he used to play in the streets in Galway as well. Was Hugh Bandet, which is more or less being blindfolded. Personne ne voit l'aveugle qui joue l'accordéon. Personne n'écoute sa musique dans la rue. Mais il écoute la foule qui passe du silence. Et il voit les notes derrière ses yeux. Et dans sa bouche, il chante les excuses du monde. No one sees the blind man who plays the accordion, no one listens to his music in the street. But he hears the crowd passing in silence, and he sees the notes behind his eyes, and in his mouth he sings every excuse in the world. Finally, this is a little poem which I wrote out of an image, a visual image, which appeared in the Irish Times. It was a wonderful photograph. I've been following the story, I'm sure a lot of people have been, and no doubt a few here. But what was going on? What is? The rape of Tara is still going on. It's gone on for reasons which we are now very, very familiar with. Although if you print them, you'll be sued.
Yeah.
That's how they've got it, but most people know why, for example, the road is being built here and not here. Really. There was a young girl called Lisa Feeney went down that hole, that duct, and decided to stay down there. It was a hugely brave thing to do, if you've actually seen the thing. I wouldn't do it. I don't know many people who would. But there was a wonderful photograph in the Irish Times of her emerging from it. I don't know if you ever saw that. And it was such a primal image of somebody being reborn into the light. And given the sight that was involved in it, the image was irresistible. I had to do something with it. So this is called L'Esprit sur Terre, which is literally the spirit on the earth. Et là, Lisa ou Yubri, les monstres arriveront avec leur grande âme, leurs mercenaires et leurs promesses pour vous chasser. Ils pilonneront leurs dieux de tigres celtiques sur vos yeux, et les journalistes vous oublieront. Ma petite, gardez bien votre chambre sous terre. Chantez en toi-même la prière que les déesses anciens vous ont donnée. Vous avez le pouvoir, vous êtes les germes qui prennent la force dans l'obscurité. And in English, basically. Lisa with the grey eyes, the monsters will arise. With their huge force, their mercenaries, worse their promises, for to chase you out. They will pile the shit of the Celtic tiger over your eyes, and the journalists will forget you. Guard well your chamber beneath the earth. Sing to yourself the prayer given to you by the old goddess. You have the power. You are the seed which germinates and gathers force in the dark. Thank you.